The American Civil War had been raging for just a little more than 2 years when the armies came into the view of the Indian lookout. Neither party, Abraham Lincoln would later say, expected for the war the magnitude or the duration which it has already attained. Hardly ever has any nation fallen into the abyss of war less prepared to wage it, or with less foresight of the costs it would have to pay. From the moment they took a republic rather than a monarchy as the shape of their government, Americans prided themselves on being a nation of peace, dedicated to the arts of commerce rather than the rapacity of empire and the spirit of war. Americans hadn't entirely given up on the call to arms. There was a war with Britain in 1812, then a war with Mexico in 1846, and ongoing flashes of conflict with uncooperative tribes of Creeks, Choctaw, Shawnee, Comanche, Kiowa, and Sioux. But none of these occurred on any great scale, and all of them could be explained away as regrettable but necessary defensive measures for the good of the Republic. There would invariably be Americans who gloried in war and killing, just as there would be anywhere. But the numbers of the bloodlusters would not be great. Even one of the small cadre of professionally trained officers produced by the Republic's Military Academy at West Point, Oliver Otis Howard, admitted to deep religious uneasiness about the glorification of war. "We cannot well exaggerate the horrors, the hateful ravages, and the countless expense of war," Howard wrote long after the Civil War's guns had fallen silent. "And stories of war serve only one purpose, to show plainly to our children that war, with its embodied woes and furies, must be avoided." This ambivalence toward wars and soldiering lent strength to the penury of the Federal Congress, which routinely set military expenditures and military personnel to a level befitting a national constabulary. At the first shot of the Civil War, the United States Army comprised only 16,357 officers and men, almost none of whom were grouped together in one place in any formidable size. Nor was there any professional association equivalent to Britain's Royal United Services Institution to foster thinking on new weapons and tactical schemes. "Nearly the whole of my 11 years' service," wrote one West Pointer of the class of 1850, "has been with my company on the frontier of Texas." And Richard Stoddart Ewell, who would wear a Confederate Lieutenant General's stars at Gettysburg in 1863, confessed that during his 20 years' service as a cavalry officer, he had learned all about commanding 50 United States Dragoons and forgotten everything else. Even this minuscule army was too much for Horace Greeley, the Mad Hatter editor of the country's most widely read newspaper, the New York Tribune. "Of all solecisms, a standing army in a republic of the 19th century is the most indefensible," Greeley announced in 1858. "We have no more need of a standing army than of an order of nobility." In the event of any national emergency, the states would put their part-time militias into federal hands, like the Prussian Landwehr in 1813, and they would provide the manpower which the regular army could deploy. The officers would emerge, like Napoleon's generals, as corporals with field marshal's batons in their packs. It was the fashion to sneer at those who had made the profession of arms their study, complained a contributor to the Army and Navy Journal, and experience in Congress was apparently regarded as a more essential qualification to command than a course of study at West Point. One lonely voice, Henry Wager Halleck, who himself had left the Army in despair and gone quite profitably into law and banking, warned that disorganized and frantic masses were not likely to provide as good a defense against invasion as the most disciplined and experienced. But it was easier to believe otherwise, and cheaper, too. In 1857, a Democratic-controlled Congress spent more money on federal judges than on armories, arsenals, and munitions of war, more on custom houses and warehouses than on fortifications and other works of defense, and more on the General Post Office building in Washington than on West Point.